This week, September 8th, 2015, on The Digital Story. Canon is developing a 250 million pixel image sensor. C-clamps and things, DIYville. The reciprocal rule of shutter speeds. All of this and more with yours truly, Derek Story, on The Digital Story. Welcome back to another Digital Story. I'm here in hot Santa Rosa, California on Labor Day weekend in September. Yep, we're well over 90 today. You know, it's interesting this time of year, the heat is different than in the heart of summer in that, yeah, we get cooking in the afternoon, but the evenings cool down and the mornings are nice. And so I can still go out for a bike ride or for a nice walk in the morning and, you know, enjoy that and then come back and hole up here in the studio, watch the thermometer rise and just kind of lay low until later on in the evening when things cool off again. It's the fall pattern here in Northern California. I don't mind it too much. You know, as long as the evening cools off, we're okay. And it's not too bad in the studio right now. Sometimes I'll tell you, it gets a little warm up here. I'm on the second story of the studio. That's where the recording room is. And, you know, obviously I can't have fans or anything going or, you know, you would hear that. It would be like, it's like when I have to sometimes record in hotel rooms when I'm on the road, you know, you have all those weird sounds. Well, I try to avoid those while I'm actually in the studio. So anyway, we have some good stuff for you today. A lot of you are probably, as I'm recording this, enjoying your last hurrah of the summer, hopefully having a good time and hopefully being safe. And then we're all going to get back to work, right? And I tell you, we got some stuff coming up this week on Wednesday. We're going to have the Apple event and we're anticipating new iPhones and we're also anticipating new iPads and possibly a new Apple TV. So that'll be kind of fun stuff and I'll definitely be watching. I'm not going to go to the event, but I'll definitely be watching the stream. And there'll be some reports on what I think is appropriate for our audience in the show next week. So we have that coming up. And then near the end of the week, I'm heading to beautiful Laughlin, Nevada. Yeah. Well, you know, there's a wedding there that I'm shooting. So you've got to go where the weddings are. But from Santa Rosa, it's a 9-hour drive, the last three through desert. Really looking forward to that travel trip. Anyway, so I'll be going down on Friday, but I will be back Sunday night, which means we'll stay on schedule and I'll be here in my studio. You know what? And probably after that trip, the studio is going to feel great on Monday. God, what? Heat? What do you mean heat? There's no heat here. All right. Okay, so we have a good show for you this week. We have lots of fun stuff going on. We'll start out with the weekly update. We're going to talk a little bit about shutter speeds and reciprocal effect. And that's something we haven't talked about in a while, and I thought we should revisit it now, especially that we have all these different sensor sizes and everything that that affect that. We'll get a little DIY action going, and I've got some other tasty morsels. So I'll tell you what, let's roll up our sleeves and get to work. Canon develops 250 megapixel sensor. Photography blog reports, Canon is developing an APS-H size CMOS sensor, incorporating approximately 250 million pixels. With CMOS imagers, increases in pixel counts result in increased signal volume, which can cause such problems as signal delays and slight discrepancies in timing. The new Canon-developed CMOS sensor, however, despite its exceptionally high pixel count, achieves an ultra-high signal readout of 1.25 billion pixels per second. Boy, that's a lot of pixels. made possible through such advancements as circuit miniaturization and enhanced signal processing technology. So that is, you know, one whopper of a sensor. So, you know, there's the technical side, but I like the way that amateur photographer reported on it, because, you know, this to me really gets to it. So this is what they said on the same thing. Canon Europe is developing a 250 million pixel imaging sensor designed to be capable of distinguishing the lettering on the side of a plane around 11 miles away. There, see, now that is something where you can read the lettering on the side of a plane 11 miles away. That is what I call some resolution. So, you know, if you read more about this, basically what Canon is saying is that they're developing this for criminal application, research, things like that. And I suppose that will be very helpful in catching the bad guys that are flying planes 11 miles away. Not that I have become cynical in my advanced years here, but, you know, you always go, okay, what else is it going to be used for? And I was just thinking, I'll tell you, talk about being able to do some serious surveillance without being seen. Seems like this image sensor would be, you know, the top dog here. And I was thinking that, you know, in places like big cities and so forth, that literally you could have these cameras totally out of view and far away and be covering a large area and be able to zoom in and see just about every details going on. I guess that's a good thing. In all honesty, it feels a little creepy as I think about it. It's probably okay though, because, you know, basically my plan on things like this is try not to think about it too much, because quite honestly, there's a lot of creepy stuff going on right now. And I'm not saying that this new Canon sensor is creepy, but it does have potential for being used that way. Anyway, it's a good thing, you know, and we'll just leave it at that. In other news, amateur photographer posts, Olympus Japan suspends sales of the OMD EM10 Mark II. Now, this is the brand new one that I just reported on a couple weeks ago. It's just been announced. And here's what they say is going on. Olympus Japan has suspended sales of its new OMD EM10 Mark II owing to an apparent glitch with the lens mount when using plastic mount lenses. Olympus Europe has yet to respond to a request for comment, and amateur photographer will publish an official statement when one becomes available. Now, this is the only place that I saw this story when I was researching this podcast, but I do think it's interesting. Now, the fact of the matter is, most of us probably don't have plastic lens mounts for our Olympus cameras. I really don't think there are that many out. I think the only one I have had was the original kit lens, the 14-42, and I think the original 40-150 had plastic. And I think that was pretty much it. So, I mean, most of my mounts are metal these days. But I'm sure, I don't know, it must be that the apparatus locks just a little too tight or something happens and those poor plastic mounts just can't take it. I'll keep an eye on this story. If something really noteworthy comes of it, I'll let you know. But for right now, I was just thinking, as we're thinking here in the U.S. primarily, although we have listeners all over the world, as we're thinking about the release date of this, and if you do use plastic mount lenses, you might want to keep an eye out to see how this story pans out. And that is this week's Weekly Update. Story number one, the reciprocal rule of shutter speeds. So I was reading a story on The Photographer about shutter speeds and, you know, different shutter speeds, minimum shutter speeds that are necessary for different types of lenses. And I was thinking, you know, wow, we haven't really talked about that for the longest time. And in part, I don't think we have, because image stabilization has become so good, so powerful, I mean, I think I have seen up to 5 stops of image stabilization on the latest cameras. 3 stops now is pretty much a given, and 4 stops is not that unusual. So we have this great image stabilization system built into a lot of our cameras, such as Olympus and Pentax. And we have these fantastic image stabilized lenses from Canon, Nikon, Sigma, Tamron, you name it. There's a bunch of them out there, Panasonic, where they're optically stabilized. And so therefore, we get sort of used to not thinking about our minimum shutter speed. In addition to this, how about this high ISO performance we're enjoying? We don't even think about ISO 1600 or really ISO 3200 anymore. Being able to raise the ISO up high and then having image stabilization, you go, well, you know, I'm not really thinking about my shutter speed so much as I am the other aspects of the shot. And, you know, for the most part, I agree, you don't have to. However, there are those situations where this does come into play. And the reason why it's worth talking about is that if it does come up and bite you on the bottom, the result is what we call camera shake. And your image will be not as sharp as you want. And as you know, when you have an image with camera shake, and in other words, it has overall softness, there's not really much you can do in post to salvage it. So then you have essentially lost a good shot. And if that even happens just, you know, 1 time out of 100, that's too many if that one shot is something that you really want. So I thought, okay, let's talk about this for a bit, because, and you know, the other thing that goes along with it is that, you know, having the right shutter speed in conjunction with image stabilization, really then that gives you, you know, powerful protection against camera shake. So I'll start out by talking, you know, exactly what is this? Well, there's this whole notion that the focal length of the lens can help you figure out what the minimum shutter speed is. And it's really quite simple, or it was really quite simple in the 35 millimeter film days, in that the focal length of a 50 millimeter lens then required a minimum shutter speed of 1/50th of a second, or we would say 1/60th of a second, because that's usually what was available to us on our shutter speed setting. So a zoom lens that's 200 millimeters in those days, minimum shutter speed would be 1/250th of a second. Zoom lens where you go, wow, I got the 400 on here. Handheld photography should be at 1/500th of a second or faster. And that's the way that works. And, you know, it's pretty straightforward. And it's, I followed it for years. I always tried to be, you know, right in that ballpark when I was shooting. And of course, image stabilization does not factor into this formula. We're just talking about when you're shooting with a camera. And now, of course, we're talking about a full frame camera with a non-stabilized lens, you know, what you should be looking at. And of course, a lot of the 50 millimeter lenses are not stabilized. So, you know, it does come into play in that situation. And of course, it's so easy to fix because we do have, you know, higher ISOs available to us. So if your shutter speed is lagging around a 30th or a 15th of a second when you've got your non-stabilized 50 millimeter lens on there, it's very easy just to raise the ISO up a couple notches and get that shutter speed up to 1/60th of a second. Use good camera holding technique. You hold it nice and steady. Squeeze the shutter. Don't jab at it. You can even take a little bit of a breath and hold it for a second while you shoot. You know, all those little things that you can do, believe it or not, it does make a difference in the sharpness of your image. You know, if you focus correctly and you're using the right shutter speed, boy, you know, your shot can be very nice. I mean, almost all the lenses these days are pretty darn sharp. So, you know, your lens is going to do its thing. What you want to do is not get in the way of your lens doing its thing. Here's the wrinkle, though, for a lot of folks. This whole formula, this whole theory, is based on a full-frame sensor. So what happens when you use an APS-C sensor? What happens when you use a Micro Four Thirds sensor? How does that change? Well, you know, remember, what we're fighting here is camera shake. And the reason why the shutter speed has to be faster as the focal length gets longer is because of magnification. The slight movements that you make when you hold the camera are magnified at 200 millimeters compared to when you're shooting with a 50. So that's why the shutter speed has to be, you know, just a bit faster. Now, when you have a crop sensor, then that affects this formula. And so if you're shooting, let's say, with a Micro Four Thirds camera, as a lot of us are, that's basically going to double that equation. So instead of shooting at 1/60th of a second when you have a 50 millimeter lens on there, you want to shoot at 1/125th of a second because of the 2x factor with Micro Four Thirds. And then on Canon cameras, you with APS-C sensor, you have 1.6. On Nikon cameras, you have 1.5. So the formula has to be adapted a bit depending on the kind of sensor that you have. Now, if you're just shooting with full-frame sensors all the time, it's really easy. 50 millimeter lens, 1/60th of a second, and on and on. And in all honesty, with Micro Four Thirds cameras, it's also very easy because it's just a straight 2x. You know, so 50 millimeter lens, 1/125th of a second. Now, of course, 2x would be 1/100th of a second, but you know, that's an odd shutter speed that, you know, you may or may not have that readout in your camera. Whereas the standard shutter speeds 1/30th, 1/60th, 1/125th, 1/250th, 1/500th, 1/1000th, on and on. Those are, you know, the standard shutter speeds that we think of. So you get the idea. All I'm doing is just rounding up a bit to the next closest shutter speed. So what if you do have image stabilization, though? Let's say that you're shooting with the 60 millimeter Olympus macro lens, and you have it on an OMD that has built-in stabilization. Then do you have to go by this rule, which would be a minimum shutter speed of 1/125th of a second for handheld? You don't, but you still want to know the rule. And the reason being is, let's say that on most of the OMDs, you have about three to four stops of image stabilization. You don't want to bring it all the way up to that. So let's say that you want a little slower shutter speed for various reasons. Let's say you don't want to jack the ISO way up high. So you want to have a little slower shutter speed than 1/125th with that 60 millimeter lens. So you know you got like three stops to play with. So go ahead and take two stops of that. So instead of 1/125th, you can go 1/60th, 1/30th. You can go, you know what? I can shoot at 1/30th of a second with the 60 millimeter lens because I have enough image stabilization to cover the spread. And you're not using up all your image stabilization, right? You're leaving yourself a little cushion there. And of course, you're going to use good camera technique. Same thing if you have the longer lens on there. Let's say that you have the 75 millimeter Olympus lens on there. That's, of course, is going to round out to 1/150th of a second, and you're going to go, I'm sort of stuck in between worlds there. So you go, 1/125th of a second will probably work with the 75. Again, I have image stabilization. And if I have to, I can probably take it down to 1/60th of a second, still have cushion, and I'm still fine. So you see the sort of thinking that goes on here. Now, again, this is a little bit harder when you're shooting with an APS-C sensor, because you're thinking 1.5 or 1.6, depending on if you're shooting a Nikon or Canon. That's just the way it is. You're already having to fool around with that formula to, you know, figure out your focal lengths. You might be used to it by now, or you just might have resigned to always using the calculator on your smartphone to figure out, you know, what the effective focal length is of your 28 millimeter lens on your, you know, Canon APS-C sensor. This is a good thing just to have bouncing around in your head, especially if you've noticed that your shots probably aren't quite as sharp as you'd like them to be. Again, chances are, you know, with the autofocusing systems being as good as they are, that you're not misfocusing that often. Remember, a missed focus shot will have some sharp area in it, right? Because you focused somewhere, right? That little green square went somewhere, and if you heard a beep, it focused on that, and that area should be sharp. And that's how you can tell the difference between a misfocused shot and a camera shake shot. A camera shake shot won't have any sharp areas. It won't have that one area that's really sharp and then everything else is out of focus, because the camera movement during the exposure just kind of softened everything. Whereas if you miss focus, something will be sharp. And so you'll always be able to tell that. This is called the reciprocal rule of shutter speeds. Now, the article that inspired me to do this piece is on the Phoblographer, and I linked to it. And then they also linked to a video that talks a little bit about this stuff. However, it's really interesting. The video doesn't really go into what the article title says it's going to. So I don't know. There's a little bit of a mismatch there, but it's all good stuff and it's all worth knowing. Story number two, C-clamps and things. I just love this part of photography. And you're going, what part is that, Derek? The part where you're just noodling around with things. You know, that's part of the reason why, in all honesty, I like my job. And, you know, way back when, one of my first jobs as a photojournalist was with a company. And, you know, I had been working for newspapers before that, which was kind of a whole different thing because you're always more or less a freelancer. At least I always was when I was working for papers, but this was like a real job. Like I was salaried and, you know, everything. I didn't have to punch into a clock, all that. And I remember my boss saying to our department, we were a communications department, saying that he wanted us to factor in a fair amount of playtime into our work week. Well, you know, this is something that you just don't hear bosses say very much. They're usually saying, you know, I need you to focus. I need you to get your job done, all that. Well, we still had to get our job done. We still had to meet our responsibilities. It wasn't playtime all the time. His point was that by doing a certain amount of experimentation, of noodling around, that we discover things. And those things that we discover sometimes help us work more efficiently or create, you know, more interesting output. And I agree with him. And I thought that was really cool. Now, in all honesty, it was harder to do that in the workplace than it is since I've been, you know, working on my own here. And the reason being is that always in the workplace, even when your boss has said that, I was always kind of looking over my shoulder and, you know, you're always a little paranoid that someone's going to think you're taking advantage of the situation or whatever. Whereas when I'm on my own, I just have the cat here, you know, at the studio. It's just the cat, no one looking over my shoulder. So I'm very disciplined. I know that I get my work done. And so it's a lot easier for me to experiment. And that's where this notion of C-clamps and other things come in, because I have created a lot of really useful stuff, especially for lighting, by just using these various things that I've picked up over the years from the hardware store or on sale from camera suppliers and so forth. And a lot of times they're nothing but, you know, clamps and of various types that have a tripod socket or a tripod screw on them so that you can screw other devices in, like a cold shoe to slide a flash in, or an extending arm or a reflector or, you know, whatever. And I have created a lot of really neat lighting schemes just using these odds and ends parts. And I've had a lot of fun doing it. I mean, that's, you know, when I'm, especially when I'm doing a portrait shoot here in the studio, part of the excitement is finding the right lighting scheme for the subject. And sometimes, you know, I have to do something completely different that I've never done before. So I have a box of all these odds and ends that I've accumulated over the years. And when I got the Olympus Air back a while ago, not that long ago, you know, I was thinking about, well, you know, what am I going to use this thing for? It has so much potential. I mean, one of the things that I think I'm going to try this upcoming weekend when I do the wedding is having the Olympus Air positioned up there at the altar, because I can control it with my smartphone, have it positioned up at the altar and take some intimate pictures right there at the altar without me having to be, you know, obstructing other people's views and stuff. So, you know, that's one thing that, you know, I came up with, and I will, hopefully I'll be able to test it out this weekend at the wedding. And then, though, I got another idea, and I actually wrote about this on the Digital Story, where I wanted to attach the Olympus Air to the handlebars of my bike. And not so much for taking pictures while I'm riding, although I have found that I am taking pictures while I'm riding, but that wasn't the original plan. The original plan was just to have a camera accessible while I'm riding, because a lot of times I've passed on pictures because I didn't want to stop the bike and dig around in my backpack, pull out the camera, take the shot, all that. So I figured if I had a camera right there on my handlebars, I could just slow down the bike or stop it or whatever, take the picture really fast, and then be about my way and be somewhat discreet and obviously capture stuff a lot quicker. So that was the original thinking. And so then I dug around in my box of C-clamps and so forth, and I found a nice clamp that had a tripod socket on it that would work great on the handlebars, the same color and everything, so it was very discreet, very low profile. And then I found a Manfrotto quick release plate and holder that was very low profile. And you know, a lot of times when we have a ball head or something with a quick release on it, the ball head, you know, sticks up, and then you have the quick release apparatus with the plate and everything. And I wanted something that was flat, that was going to go right on the C-clamp. Well, I had bought this Manfrotto quick release in the past for some other project. I used it and then, you know, had put it away. And it was perfect for this. Now, it doesn't have a ball head, right? It's just the quick release plate and the holder, the quick releaser or whatever you want to call it there. And then it screws right into my C-clamp. So now I have a very low profile device that I can attach the Olympus Air to. And I really needed a quick release plate so that when I stopped to go in a convenience store or something, then I could take the Air off it, throw it in my backpack. You know, obviously you don't want to leave it on the bike. And it's worked out really cool. It's just been fabulous. And I just had this stuff laying around in a box. So my point is that chances are good that you have such a box, or you have a lot of these items. Now, if you have a lot of these items and they're spread out all over the place, I highly recommend putting them all in one place. Because what happens is, I've noticed this, that when I get the inspiration for a project like this, I want to find the tools that I know I have right away. I don't want to be digging around for them, because that really kills the momentum. For instance, I thought the Manfrotto plate was in one box and is actually in another box. I have a couple boxes of this stuff. And even that little delay of looking through the one box first, not finding it, slowed me down a little bit. And I was just thinking, man, if I wasn't organized, if I didn't keep this stuff accessible, then a lot of these projects would never see the light of day, because, you know, you just get frustrated when you can't find what you're looking for. So if you keep these sort of odds and ends, I recommend that you find a spot in, you keep them all together, and when you're done using it, put it back in that spot, whether it's a box or a tray or a drawer, whatever you're using, so that next time inspiration hits, then you can find what you need right away, build it, and start testing it while you're all excited about it. And you know, that's when it's really neat. So this sort of stuff is a lot of fun. And you know, we have cameras most of us, we have cameras, old compacts and things like that, where we can experiment a little bit with them. Obviously, if we have a GoPro, I mean, that obviously that's designed for all these sort of things. But something to play with where you can get a different kind of shot, you can position the camera a different kind of way. And of course, with built-in Wi-Fi now on these cameras, that really extends the possibilities. It's a lot of fun to do something different and not just kind of shoot the same way all the time. Okay, let's take a stroll over to the lynda.com screening room. And today's selection is Exploring Photography, Exposure and Dynamic Range with Ben Long. And I'll tell you, Ben Long is one of my favorite photography instructors on Lynda right now. And this is a good one. It's called Exploring Photography, Exposure and Dynamic Range. And he really helps you understand what's going on with your digital camera when you're looking at a scene that has highlights and middle tones and dark areas, and what your eyes see and what the camera can do. If you really want to get your head around that, this is a perfect title for that, and you can find it right now on lynda.com, Exploring Photography, Exposure and Dynamic Range with Ben Long. And you can also start your 7-day free trial if you haven't done so already by going to our landing page on Lynda, which is lynda.com, lynda.com/thedigitalstory. Start your 7-day free trial there. Watch Ben's titles, because he has many of them. Watch my titles. Watch everything that's going on and really kind of brush up on a few things or learn something completely new. That's what this site is so good for. lynda.com, lynda.com/thedigitalstory. Okay, let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. I have a word from Sizzlepix here, and I'm going to read you this. This is good food for thought. The 5K ultra high definition Sizzlepix is the upgrade now in general release on all orders. So you can display your best photography in sizes from 18 inches to 6 feet with resolution and realism one expects only from the small screens on handheld phones and iPads. Sizzlepix clients say, contrary to expectation, resolution seems to increase as their photos grow larger. Sizzlepix invites photographers to order a print from the assembly line plants that shall remain unnamed, and a 5K ultra-high definition Sizzlepix from the same image. Compare them side by side. They've never once had a client declare they like the mass-produced print better. If yours is the first, you may return your Sizzlepix for a full refund. Yep, and I think that's well put. I mean, that's straight from them. And I think they nail it on the head, which is there is a difference between what Sizzlepix does and what the other folks are doing on metal. And the Sizzlepix difference is noticeable. And believe me, every time I go to a trade show or something, I check out the competition, and it just reaffirms what I already know, what I already look at every day hanging on the walls of my studio, which are nothing but Sizzlepix. I don't have any of those other types. SizzlePix.com, and they have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. I have an idea for you from Red River Paper. Do you know a scrapbooker? Red River Paper has an entire page dedicated to those who love making scrapbooks. And I have the link in the show notes. You just click on it and take it right there. And it includes a link to their scrapbookers sampler for only $14.99, which is really cool. It's a collection of papers, inkjet papers, designed for scrapbookers. So I think this is pretty fun stuff. And, you know, the thing is that if you are a scrapbooker, part of you know, your art is the actual, you know, way that you choose your materials and assemble your materials in addition to the words and imagery that you're using. And, you know, because Red River Paper has such a broad selection of paper, all these different types, you really can create your own look, your own feel. And if you know a scrapbooker, send them over to this page. Let them take a look around. Have them, you know, try the sampler kit where they can play with all the different papers and see what they like. It might help them find the perfect combination of materials to express their photos and their words. It's really kind of cool. So anyway, Red River Paper, they have a tile on all the pages of the Digital Story, and they have a beautiful Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. All right, I think that is going to do it for me today. It's been a lot of fun talking about shutter speeds and DIY stuff. And it's funny, you know, just to kind of tie those two stories together before I sign off here. So I did take a lot of pictures when I first put the Olympus Air on my bicandle bars. And I was sort of wondering how they look, but the shutter speeds were high enough because the Olympus Air doesn't have image stabilization built in. It's one of the reasons why I was interested in that topic. And because the shutter speeds were high enough, even while writing, the pictures look pretty cool, pretty sharp. Yeah. So this whole shutter speed, there's a lot to it. It's a good, you know, we know this stuff and then we forget because we start thinking about other things. So hopefully this is a good reminder, and do a little play this week. I'm going to head down to Laughlin and shoot a wedding, and I'm going to watch the Apple event. And so there's going to be lots to talk about next week. Hopefully I'll have a new announcement myself. So make sure you come back and join me. Until then, have a great week. Bye-bye now.